you are.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. As the Bush administration gears up for a possible, some say probable, invasion of Iraq, they're meeting resistance from military brass. And the resistance is coming in all forms. Leaders are fighting over the number of troops to deploy, whether to use more sophisticated technologies, whether to engage in covert or overt operations, leading up to the big question, how to oust Saddam Hussein. And the split between the military and civilian leadership has gone beyond frustrated mumbling in Pentagon hallways, appearing on the front page of newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. Contrary to public belief, the military has historically been conservative and cautious when reviewing war options. Is its caution this time around undermining the executive branch's efforts to build a national consensus? Connection listeners, when is it appropriate for military leaders to question the administration? And what do you think of military and civilian leaders duking it out before the American public? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. My guests today are Richard Cohn, professor and chairman of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and William Nash, retired Major General of the U.S. Army and director of the Council on Foreign Relations Center for Preventative Action. But first, let's talk to Eric Schmidt, military correspondent of the New York Times. Welcome, Eric.
Good morning, Jackie.
I know that you can't reveal your sources, but you did break a fairly spectacular story on July the 5th about plans for a possible invasion of Iraq, which detailed scenarios that have had everyone in Washington buzzing ever since. So let us know something about what foments behind these kinds of leaks. Obviously, someone inside is concerned and wants it known and debated in the press, right?
Yeah, I mean, what's happened here is in the course of my reporting, I came across some access to a very sensitive planning document. It was in its early stages down in the one of the planning cells at the Central Command, which is the military's main command in Tampa, Florida, that's responsible for planning military contingencies in the Middle East and for Iraq. And there are certain people in the military, inside and outside the military, actually, who are concerned that some of the planning is not creative enough, is not imaginative enough, and doesn't really take into account some of the advances in tactics and technology that the United States military has made since the last Gulf War.
And now, those concerns about it not being creative enough are coming from inside the Pentagon?
Well, you're hearing the criticism both from inside the Pentagon and from outside the Pentagon. What you have are certain military planners who are very concerned that you basically have enough force to take care of any possibility. You don't want to go in too light, in other words, mm-hmm. if you have to deal with a threat that suddenly spins out of control. I mean, the military plans for the worst-case scenarios in many instances, and certainly when you're dealing with Iraq, even though it's not as strong a military force as it was in 1990-91, it's still a formidable adversary.
Well, speaking of possible concerns, Eric, of course, this is all happening in the context of how many fronts can be opened by the United States. We have the Middle East in flames, Afghanistan still an ongoing concern, and whether or not Iraq can even be sustained. Isn't that right?
That's right, and that's why the president, while he's repeatedly called for regime change in Iraq, has been very careful to not talk about when that might happen or how it might happen. When he's asked about this, both he and his senior advisors say this is something that's under careful consideration, that there's no war plan before the president right now, that this is something they're obviously having to take into consideration, not only with allies in Europe and the Middle East, but with the Congress, and ultimately will have to take up with the American people.
Okay, thanks, Eric. General William Nash and Professor Richard Cohn, what do you think about the fact that this is increasingly being duked out in the newspapers, that there's not just a trickle of leaks, but quite a rush of them? So obviously, there is a lot of debate going on, right?
Well, it's DeCone. I think that's true, and it's surprising because this administration has been very hard on leaks. Secretary Rumsfeld and the president have made it very clear that they don't like it. But I think we should point out that some of this leaking, as is always the case, comes from the very top. In response to that first reporting...
You mean the Joint Chiefs of Staff? I mean, you say the very top. How far up are we going?
I think not necessarily the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but from senior civilian leaders. Eric Schmidt mentioned that it's not just in the Pentagon that some of this leaking is coming. And in response, it seems that openly Secretary Rumsfeld is pressuring the military for more creative options. A lot of the reporting says that the civilians are frustrated. So it's not just the military saying, in effect, kind of out of school, look, there are problems here that the civilians need to consider. This is an equal opportunity leaking exercise.
Yeah, this is Bill Nash. I just wanted to add that I don't think we should fall into the assumption. Eric may want to clarify his sources to us, but I don't think we want to jump to the assumption that all these leaks are coming from uniformed personnel. The fact of the matter
that's
is...
That's fair enough.
Yeah, it is good that a decision to go to war is debated. It is not necessarily good that some of these plans that are extremely sensitive would be aired publicly.
Well,
and I personally have a difficulty with the issue of leaking.
Well, General Nash, do you think that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld thinks it's so good for these plans to be debated? Or would President Bush agree?
Well, you'll have to ask them that question. But the fact of the matter is it's good for the nation on whether that we have a debate over whether we make a deliberate decision to go to war with a sovereign nation or not. My point is that this debate, and there's a lot of indicators from Eric Schmidt's article that would indicate that the frustration over the lack of creativity is coming from those that may not have quite as much as, to use your expression, battlefield wisdom as we might desire.
Eric, when you address people and you promise them confidentiality, are you trying to elucidate their concerns about feasibility, or are you trying to give them a platform just so that these ideas can be knocked around?
Well, first of all, you have to establish their credentials. I mean, is this somebody who has access to information that's accurate, that's genuine, that's legitimate? That's the first thing I had to do when I got access to this information. Then you have to assess the motivations for the person giving it to you. And I think Bill Nash is right in to say it's not necessary to assume this is from a military official. But you have to assess that, and then you have to, in my case, let your readers know where this person is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
What are their motivations for discussing this, so that they can take that into account when they read the account of the information.
Well, the only thing that seems to be a matter of broad consensus is bad things are happening in Baghdad, and that Saddam Hussein is a bad actor, and it would be better if he were not there. After that, every single approach seems to be a matter for a huge debate. Is this typical, would you say, General Nash?
Well, I think so. I think one of your first requirements is to clarify your objectives and exactly the circumstances under which that you're willing to go to war. I would agree that there's a general consensus that Saddam Hussein regime should change in Iraq. That's probably a view that's held many more places than just in the United States. He has few friends outside of Iraq and not that many inside of Iraq. But it is also legitimate to try to figure out exactly how timely or how time-sensitive his threat is to outside Iraq, and what are the probabilities that he would use these weapons of mass destruction, if he has them, without provocation, or what are the consequences if we do attack, and what would he do then? The point being is that this is not a casual decision and must be thoroughly examined.
I'd like to know, General Nash, more about your experience about how these debates happen in those veritable Pentagon hallways that we've all visited and read about. I mean, are people, do you really feel free to discuss and to disagree with what you might consider to be well known in terms of the White House's desires to depart from what the Commander-in-Chief may think is essential?
Well, debate within the confines of proper procedures is not only appropriate, it's absolutely essential. It is quite legitimate for military leaders to ask the questions of their political leaders in order to clarify the objectives, the constraints and restraints, and in-state, if you will, that is desired to be achieved. And then it's incumbent upon the military to lay out a variety of options to achieve those objectives within the constraints and restraints that the political leaders give them. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, present to them a variety of options with associated risks that the variety of courses of action might entail.
General Nash, Dick here. Could I ask you, is it appropriate, though, for the military to give opinions on the appropriateness of the policy or whether the policy will succeed? And in this discussion in private with their political superiors, and if they do disagree with the answers they get, whether it's appropriate for them to speak to the press about any of it, either the military aspects of it or the policy overall. We've heard reporting since Eric broke the story that there's a lot of disagreement with the policy from uniformed leaders in various parts of the military.
And Richard Cohn, doesn't your own research show that a lot of people in the military feel that it is really okay to talk to the press if they disagree with the policy?
Well, we did a survey of officers and civilians in 1998, 1999 at the Triangle Institute for Security Studies, and we asked the question directly of all concerned, when is it acceptable for a military member to leak unclassified information or documents to the press? And to our surprise, only about 50% of the officers thought that it was never. Actually, quite a bit less than 50% thought it was never proper to leak even unclassified material. And that speaks perhaps to a professional ethic that's changed from at least pre-World War II years when Omar Bradley, as he wrote in his memoirs, said that 32 years in the peacetime army told him to do his job, keep his mouth shut, and keep his name out of the papers.
Those were the days. Okay, well, General Nash, we'll get back to you in just a minute. You're listening to The Connection. Join us at 1-800-423-8255 when we come back.
From Boston University.
This is The Connection. I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Dick Gordon. We're talking this morning about splits between the administration and civilian leaders and also, of course, military planners as to the strategies on how to fight a possible war against Iraq and whether or not that should be a matter of wide public discussion, sometimes perhaps too public. General William Nash, we were speaking to you just before the break. By the way, the number to call to join us is 1-800-423-8255. Is there some kind of difference, would you say, about how candid to be post-Vietnam, with this post-Vietnam generation saying, I think I should be, even if you're inside the military, saying in the back of your mind, if it's not in the best interest of the country, I think I have a right to talk to the press?
Well, let me parse that. Dick Cohn asked too many questions there for me to answer comprehensively, but just a couple of things. Number one, it's very important that within the confines of the Pentagon, if you will, or the Central Command, that issues be debated, questions be asked, assumptions be challenged, etc., because it's important to thoroughly vet all the issues associated with something as momentous as going to war. The second point I would make, it is good for the military, and Dick Cohn can talk much more about this, to have a relationship with the American public so that they understand what their Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps are doing. And so I guess I'm a bit of a liberal on interface with the press, but I'm certainly a hardliner on not revealing classified information. Absolute there. And with respect to unclassified information, a curious term, I think you have to use a great deal of judgment and sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
The last point I would make is we should not confuse civilian control of the military, which comes from the National Command Authority, the President and the Secretary of Defense, and of course the responsibilities of Congress to raise and support the armies and navies, with a disagreement with somebody in uniform and somebody who doesn't wear a uniform over an issue. In other words, debate is legitimate. It's only after the decision is made that the National Command Authority, and of course Congress in appropriate ways, has the rule. Then the soldier, sailor, airman, and Marine has two choices: faithfully execute the orders given or look for work.
As some of them have been doing. If the debate affects policy, that seems to be where at least our political leaders, Donald Rumsfeld, has promised that he's going to get to the bottom of who leaked these plans. Eric Schmidt, do you find that there's a kind of day-after effect for your sources? You know, pressure's been building, your source wants to talk, sees it in the newspaper. What happens the next day? Does the source dry up?
Well, it's funny. It's actually two things have happened. One is, again, to underscore what some of the other speakers have said, this administration prizes secrecy perhaps more than any other. And I think these leak investigations that Secretary Rumsfeld has launched are meant to try and clamp down on some of these things. I don't think they're necessarily going to try and go after and prosecute somebody, but they're clearly trying to preempt any other leaks. But in terms of...
Is it working?
It's had a double effect. I mean, certainly some people are a little more wary of talking to me, but I've been struck at the number of other people who've called and or emailed me and said they're very supportive of what the reporting has been, not just in the Times, but in other publications. And, oh, by the way, here's something else you might look into. So I think it's emboldened certain people to speak out. They feel like they're not alone in some of their concerns. And then obviously other people feel that maybe it's best to keep quiet for right now, but come back and talk to me and other reporters a little bit later when the heat's off a bit.
Jackie, it's Dick here. I agree with much of what General Nash has said, but I think there's a great danger first of all, in the debating of war plans or the leaking of, and I agree with that, but I think there's a great danger in having military people, whether they're senior or even mid-level, debating policy, which is really not their brief in this process, or debating even military aspects publicly before a decision is made, because it politicizes the military and it destroys the bond of trust that's necessary between military and civilian leaders in deciding these things. And I can give you some examples. If you were to think of George Marshall leaking whether it was really a good idea to occupy Iceland in the middle of 1941 or whether the lend-lease policy was good, or even leaking whether we ought to be giving so much of our precious military equipment first to the British and then to the Russians, that would not have been good in 1941. just as these kinds of things are not good today. And when in fact the United States' war plan, the victory plan, was essentially published in the Chicago Tribune a few days before Pearl Harbor, the Roosevelt administration went ballistic on that subject. And so there is a history to this business, and there are very great dangers involved.
Well, a line between being informed and being part of a wide public debate, which everyone seems to be calling for, and revealing information that might be compromised. Eric Schmidt, I think that you have got to go away.
Yeah, before I do, I just want to make one last point to not leave readers and listeners, rather, with the impression that we're just publishing this stuff willy-nilly. When I got access to this information after confirming it was legitimate, after assessing the motivations of the source, my editors and I went to the Pentagon and spent a couple of days discussing with very senior Pentagon officials what we intended to publish and listening to their reservations. And I think what ended up appearing in the paper was something we both could live with. I'm sure the military wasn't happy that this was out at all, but I think in terms of having a piece that was responsibly handled, I think it did the best it could. And I didn't hear any objections, at least, from senior military officials about any of the content of the piece itself. Nobody accused the Times of jeopardizing national security or endangering American lives. I think we talked about it in a general enough way that it did not do that. So we tried to handle a very sensitive subject in a responsible way.
That's really very, very interesting. Is that policy for the newspaper at the Post?
Well,
has that happened in
you,
other kinds of leaks?
Certainly,
if you
have a very sensitive subject, it's not unprecedented for the newspaper and its senior editors to have discussions with administration officials, at least to hear them out, hear their objections. We don't always honor those objections, but in some cases, in matters of national security and military sensitivity, such as this one was, we listened hard, and I think we incorporated some things in the story that accounted for that.
Okay. Well, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jackie.
This is Bill Nice. Jackie, if I could... First of all, basically, I agree with what Dick Cohn said about the sensitive nature of policy discussions in the public. And at the same time, what happens, though, is a situation that Eric just described, or similar circumstances, where faced with a story, it's important for the military to have a relationship with the reporters and with the industry that allows them to sit down and have a very frank discussion. And sometimes you may need to explain some of these things in an off-the-record basis, most likely, to the point to where there is an understanding of the national security implications. But as far as having a debate over use of Iceland or use of Lend-Lease, I agree completely. Those sensitive type issues are not helpful to the nation to be carried on in public.
Well, let's ask members of this great nation what they think and go to the phones, and we'll take a call from Richard, who's joining us from Boston. Hello, Richard.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for being
Earlier this year, the Bush administration did something that no administration since Truman had done, which was to open up for quasi-public discussion or review the nuclear profile, i.e. the notion of first strike, whether it be strategic or larger. How much does General Nash or anyone else, for that matter, think that process, kind of mentored by Richard Pearl and some other civilians, may have caused alarm within the Pentagon? And what force does that bring to this discussion and the need to vet it publicly?
Who wants to take that one?
Well, I would say to you that some of this has to do, and again, Professor Cohn can talk more about it, but there is a difference in perspective on approaching some of these problems. And the issues of battlefield wisdom that Jackie used, and I really like that expression, Jackie.
Well, I have covered a couple of wars myself, I do give the military credit for a lot of successful operations, General Nash.
Right.
So.
And as... As Richard said, some of these things, and you start bringing out the possibilities, and it does scare, and if I may, scare the hell out of some people to think that there might be a propensity to use nuclear weapons quicker than we've ever imagined before, the propensity to go to war, to initiate a regime change without thinking through all the consequences. As one former boss of mine used to say, hope is not a method. I would add neither is ideology.
Mm.
And so you've really got to work a lot of these very serious issues out in a profound way. And I think some of this public discussion of policy comes from those who are motivated by a ideological view more than necessarily one who is loyal to the policy and trying to find out how to do it after all the talking's done.
I think you mentioned – oh, I'm sorry, Richard?
Well, I was just going to not only agree with General Nash, but reemphasize that these are really large political and strategic questions that require public debate. And political leaders themselves recognize that changes of those magnitude need some public discussion to see whether the American people are willing to go along with such things.
General Nash, you mentioned something that had happened on President Truman's watch. And I'd like to refer to, I think also you were talking about if military leaders really don't like something, they can walk. And this refers to General Douglas MacArthur and his farewell address to the U.S. Congress, in which he said after he had been relieved of command by President Truman in April of 1951, because he was accused of acting on his own initiative over the conflict in Korea. And he said, like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye. We've had at least one general, General Downing, retire. Think there'll be more?
Well, I tell you what, you really go to the extreme of the argument when you bring up MacArthur.
Oh, well, that's good to know. It gives us a baseline here.
Well, he was trying to undermine the Truman administration's policy.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, there was a little leaking there. It was all public and deliberate. No, I think in some cases, and I can't, again, I can't speak to why General Downing made the decision, but it's certainly not at all dishonorable to state your disagreement and said, in light of that, I will go on to other work. The other thing I think, at least from my perception, is General Downing has not made a old soldier's fade away kind of remark. He just went out, I believe, to Colorado and is kind of going about his business.
But it points early on, doesn't it, to a difference of opinion over how to, you talked about hope not being a method, about differences of opinion about the feasibility of invading Iraq at all. Right?
Well, one of the other legacies of Vietnam is some angst and anguish, rather, on the part of a number of senior leaders that they didn't act more decisively and allowed themselves to be participants in something that they truly did not believe. The method of going about, while I think there was agreement that it was necessary to fight in Vietnam, at least in the early days, there was not agreement on how to do it. And I think there are some... There's one of the legacies of Vietnam is that there is a greater understanding that staying on to see if you can make bad policy executed well is not the route to take. So I think there may be a greater propensity for those who disagree to, in fact, move on.
Okay. You're listening to The Connection. The number to call to join in the discussion about whether civilian or military leaders will prevail in the debate about what to do on Iraq is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thanks to Richard from Boston. And now we're going to another Richard joining us from Cambridge, Mass. Hello.
Hi.
I don't want to call you Richard II, just
right.
But I'm tempted.
I just wanted to make two points, and my perspective is that of a retired reservist. I retired last year, so I guess I'm looking at this not only from the military standpoint, but from the standpoint of a civilian. Point number one, I'm surprised to find that I'm more in agreement with General Nash than with the civilian professor. I really believe that the military officer has a duty to speak up and be heard on policy issues, not implementation issues once a decision has been made, but on policy issues. And I'll tell you, because the debate hasn't focused on it, in a personal way, why I feel that way. As an officer, I realize, as the more senior I got, that the military, the sharp end of the spear, are kids. They're 22-year-old, 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids. And if we're talking about a war, we're talking about sending these kids out. And I just haven't heard people mention how awful that kind of decision is. And I think military officers have to be heard if the question is whether to go to war at all. Point number two, the reason you have leaks is because the national institutions, the media, the political leaders really have not discussed this issue the way they should. There's no Senator Fulbright anymore. That Senate committee hearing for 2 days last week was a farce. There's really been no public debate, and I think out of that frustration, people may be trying to inject information into the media to provoke that debate.
Well, what do both of you think about that? I'd like to hear from both. Thank you very much, Richard. From both Richard Cohn and also General Nash, has there been enough public debate?
Well, I think it's just beginning, and I think there's going to be a lot of it. But I don't think I have to disagree with Richard about whether the military ought to be debating these political questions of war. No one really elects military leaders. They're chosen, they're subordinate by the Constitution and by tradition. And while their viewpoint must be heard and these debates must go on, very strong debates and very very real clashes of opinion and analysis often inside an administration, I think decisions to go to war are political ones that we elect leaders to make, and they're not just the president's either. There's, for good reason, that decision was put in the Congress, the representatives of the people, and no president is supposed to be able to take the country to war by him or herself.
All right. Well, we're not trying to weigh in and say that it should be a civilian decision by not hearing from General Nash. We'll come back to him next and get in on the conversation about who should lead, military or our White House, the president, the civilians. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection, and we're talking about how to steer the debate over whether or not to invade Iraq and who decides. Is it obviously at the end, it's the decision of the commander-in-chief, but a long way between there and that decision, weighing in from civilian leaders, weighing in from military planners, and the split between those sides at the moment as to which path is the appropriate one. Coming back with our guest, General William Nash, a retired Army Major General and Director for the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. General Nash, as we think about the cost in human life, both Iraqi life and American soldiers, are we thinking about policy? Are we trying to think about containment, which some military planners say has worked very well, and why not pursue that? As you know, over the weekend, Joe Biden, who held these hearings last week, said he thought this was inevitable.
Yes. I wanted to make a couple of comments about discussing policy. The issue that the military faces is policy is made manifest by action. And those who execute that policy need to make sure that they understand and their leaders understand the full ramifications of the policy. And I go back to Eric Schmidt's article where he talked about whether that this could one of the reports was that up to 8 countries could be used as launching bases.
None of which had been consulted in advance. Yes.
None of which had been consulted. But leaving that aside for a moment, none of those 8 are comparable to World War II England, where they were full ally and participant in the campaign against Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so by just choosing one of those countries to work in requires a certain amount of security force to ensure that we can act unencumbered. Bringing additional forces in there to protect those who are launching the attack against Iraq is a policy issue as well as a military problem. And so it's nice to say that the military is not should not be discussing the policy, but the fact of the matter is that the execution of the policy is policy itself, and they must become involved in that debate. The second point I would make is that every senior officer, and I say that at 3-star and above, have to pledge to make sure that they pledge that they will speak their mind to the Congress of the United States when so asked about it. And this places the military officer in a very important position to where he must respond without regard to administration views when questioned by the Congress of the United States.
Is that an oath they take when they advance up the ranks?
It's a commitment they make as part of their confirmation process. And it is a basic element of civilian control of the military. So there is a requirement to speak their mind.
Let's get our listeners in and let them speak their mind a bit, okay? We're speaking to Ron, who's calling us from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Ron.
Good morning. I've been enjoying the conversation. The last gentleman, I agree with a lot of what he said. I feel that the policy that gets discussed with the administration, as far as generals, their primary, I think, responsibility is to the soldiers, meaning the political leadership has to weigh what consequences will occur, obviously, when some military action takes place. I think the generals need to be the advocates of the soldiers who die on the battlefield. And I think when generals keep that in mind, they normally prosecute the military action in the Western way, which America, as well as other European countries at times, have prosecuted correctly, which is decisive battle, not trying to conduct a society as if there's no war going on.
Mm-hmm. Is that accurate, Richard Cohn? And also, when we talk about bringing this whole debate into account, let's remember the Bush administration was not at these hearings last week. But respond to Ron, if you would.
Well, I think he's absolutely right that senior military leaders are always act as a mediating force between the armed forces and the political leadership, and they have to represent the viewpoints and the interests and the needs of their military services to the political leadership, and then represent to the armed forces through their own leadership the decisions of the political people. And I think General Nash is perfectly right that the way in which military views can be aired to the American people is when they are invited or required to testify before Congress and give their private views. That's very different, of course, from leaking things or talking to the press privately. And I think that's an important distinction that has to be made.
Okay. General Nash, isn't their primary responsibility, though, to the American Constitution?
That's exactly right. Military leaders are not labor representatives. The great philosophical question that you have to address in every leadership class from sergeant level to general level is, what's more important, the mission or the men? A non-gender specific term. And the answer to the question is yes. Because the fact of the matter is, military leaders have to serve the American people as a whole, and they have to serve their soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines as well. So you have to balance the issues of doing the job and at the same time taking care of the great men and women that serve. So it's not an either or.
All right.
No, can I just say one last thing? I agree with the last statement about the fact that they have to serve the Constitution as well as the men and women. I feel that if they're on a mission in the battlefield where they're going to risk more lives than they'd like to, but for the betterment of the country, the nation, the military, they do that, which our men and women have done so well in the past. That's completely reasonable and just. But as you said, you know, the back room, I got a reporter, and I'm leaking this out. That, to me, doesn't seem to fit their job description. Even though you don't like to see a senator or congressman doing that, to me, that the squabbling of politics, that's what we do every day. We fight it out every day in Congress. That's
okay.
Why we're a democracy.
All
anyway,
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Ron. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Chris, who is calling us from Wilton, Iowa. Hello, Chris.
Hello there. I just have a couple comments. I would, whoever did leak this information, I consider them one of my personal heroes, because I'm against this, the idea of invading Iraq after over a decade of oppressive economic sanctions. I think only cursory attention has been given, maybe one comment during this whole conversation, to the people of Iraq, who will obviously suffer the brunt of any military action, whether it be, you know, sensible, targeted, untargeted. Those people have suffered, are suffering, and will suffer more. And I think no one is speaking for them in this case.
Well, let's remind listeners that sanctions have been going on for 10 years, and sanctions have enacted severe penalties on the Iraqi population, the malnutrition and deaths of children. I mean, we should remind everyone that there are sanctions called the policy of containment already in place.
Well, one of the things, this is Bill Nash, one of the things, Chris, be careful about who you pick for your heroes, because the fellow that leaked that story to Eric was not looking to stop the attack. He just wanted a more creative way of attacking Iraq.
Well, that leads me to my follow-up question. Would there even be a debate now had this information not been leaked, or would it only be a debate after the fact?
Oh, I think Dick Cohn here. I think there would have been a debate. It was building the president's statements about regime change were sure to head us toward an enormous debate, and it would have inevitably have come down to the how as well as the whether.
Richard, I just want to ask you, we had just 2 days of debate in up on Capitol Hill, and Joe Biden said that he hadn't asked the administration to come on down because he didn't want them to feel compelled to defend their arguments. I think it was Mr. Biden. It might have been someone else, but in any way, they weren't invited down. Do you expect that there will be more debates on policy here?
I certainly do. I think there's going to be at least some discussion in the House as well as the Senate on the floor about whether we ought to undertake regime change by force in Iraq, and that will, I think, will end up in a not only a great debate but some congressional action, and that will be well covered and it'll take quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Okay. Let's go to another caller. Christian is calling from Boston.
Yes, interesting topic. Good morning. I was thinking about Colin Powell, and you know, during the Gulf War, he was chief of staff, and of course, you know, they went and he served the mission to kick the Iraqi soldiers from Kuwait, and now he's the Secretary of State, and it doesn't seem that he's comfortable with an idea for another war, another invasion, you know, and there is a split in the White House between the military and the politicians, the diplomats overall, and I would like to know, what do you think about this policy?
I think it's an excellent question. Let's put it to General Nash, meaning the value of Colin Powell was that he had military experience, that he is a general, and now is he being crowded out of the debate here?
Well, I can't answer that. I would just say that going back to the overall issue of debate, the fact of the matter is, and General Powell, I think, is one of the great men of our times, but he's also one of them who is looking past the immediate action of an attack or a regime change. I think one of the problems is you have to look through the entire scope of what may or may not happen. One of the things General Powell, rightfully, as Secretary of State, is concerned with is, what's it look afterwards, and what are the post-conflict actions, and what's the implications for not only the region but globally should this operation take place? Again, how you do it will have an impact on what how it turns out. And so it is rightful not only to look at changing Saddam Hussein, but also what happens afterwards. And I think that's kind of the role that the Secretary of State rightfully plays.
Richard Cohn, would you speak to whether or not Colin Powell is having perhaps enough of an impact on the argument here to satisfy your judgment at least?
Well, I don't think we can know, but if you want me to speculate, I would say he's having an enormous impact on it because he's forcing the kinds of broader issues that General Nash talks about, and even forcing people to consider what the implications are for the United States' role in the world, not only now but long term, if it undertakes what many in the world would call an aggressive war, we would call a preemptive war, to the United States' role. And that's his job as the person responsible for United States foreign policy. And the fact that he's willing to get in there and fight toe-to-toe, day in and day out, bureaucratically and in the press, he's no longer a military officer, he's a cabinet officer, it seems to me very positive producing the most appropriate and the most effective policies.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you both generally, we just have a couple minutes left. Are we in any kind of turning point situation here in terms of a full airing before this could be the first preemptive war or first strike war, whatever you like to call it, the United States conducts? And does that not underscore the tension between military and political planners and who decides, Congress or the President?
Well, I don't know if this is a watershed or not, but there's not too many examples in our history of us deliberately choosing to go to war. We've taken great pride that it's been forced upon us in the past. And I would say that underlines the importance of the public debate on this issue. But at the same time, I want to go on record as I'm against leaks, and that should be debated within the administration by the military in front of Congress as they are asked. But a much wider political debate is certainly necessary for something like this.
I'm not sure at this point that we know whether this is something totally new, but clearly the stakes are enormous, not only for the long-term role of the United States in the world, but for the war on terrorism. If we were to undertake this over the objections of the countries in the Middle East that we will need and the rest of the Muslim world, the chances for a misstep and for unanticipated consequences are just enormous. And so it is critical, and I think the public debate is absolutely indispensable. The American people need to consider and to debate among themselves.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for joining us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. My guests today were retired General William Nash, director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Richard Cohn is professor and chairman of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Earlier, we spoke with Eric Schmidt, military correspondent of the New York Times. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Lisa Chow, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugart. Graham Smith is our senior producer, and I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web